I think we'll get started and let any other people walk in afterwards. I am Cindy Molobita, and this is the first of five sessions exploring the Columbus Quincentenary from the perspective of the Gospel of Mark, or in the light of the Gospel of Mark. I would simply say for openers that throughout these five sessions, in exploring different aspects of the Quincentenary, we will weave four different journeys into our inquiry. And one of those journeys, obviously, is the journey of the Europeans to the Americas 500 years ago, or which began 500 years ago. The second journey, and I've tried to put these in a circle up here, and obviously the pen wasn't good enough, but if you can see, I've named Columbus' journey here, which we just talked about. Also integral to this discussion will be what I call our own personal cultural journeys, looking at the coming of our peoples, individually, our ancestors to this continent, looking at our own cultural journeys, our relationships as people to people who are other, who are different from us, of different cultures and different ways, different classes. The third journey is the discipleship journey in the time of Christ, and the fourth journey is our own discipleship journeys. In other words, as people of Christ, our responses to issues that are raised in the looking at the Quincentenary. I guess I would also say that it grates against every fiber in me to not spend some time before we dig in, finding out who each other are and finding out what you want out of this session and what you bring to this session. But given 1 hour, I think that doesn't make sense for us to do. So I simply have to, in a sense, name the apology that we don't have time to offer a little bit more about what we want out of this and who we are. We will use five different tools in these sessions. One of them is the voices of people who were oppressed by and have offered resistance to what they name the conquest of the Americas. A second tool is what I've termed social analysis, tools for understanding, for digging into some of the reasons for and the consequences of what has happened by virtue of the Europeans landing on this continent. A third tool is personal cultural histories, actually asking questions about our own histories culturally. A fourth is biblical reflection, and a fifth is how do we respond? And to me, any look at social issues without attaching onto it, how do we respond, is an inadequate look. And so we will attempt to, in each session, at least add a little bit of that. I'd like to light here four candles. I think you always light the furthest away one first, don't you, to keep your clothes and hair up? This requires special compensation from the executive director to light candles in this fire danger place, so don't let me forget to burn them out at the end. Blow them out. These candles are in honor of the peoples of four different continents, the peoples of Africa, whose life as a people was incredibly disrupted in the conquest of the Americas. The Africans, many talk about three different stages. The first passage, their life in Africa. The second passage, the move from Africa to this continent in the pits of slave ships. And the third passage being now, life in the Americas. Another continent, the European continent. Another continent, that of North America, and that of South America. Although we'll cover a lot of territory today, I think that we must acknowledge that part of that territory is looking at and stepping into the lands of other peoples, and I think that it's important that we do that with reverence and with honor. I think that to step into the lands of another is in a sense, to step into holy territory, and we must do it honoring the people whose lives we're looking at. Let's take a next step now and begin by listening to some voices, three different voices speaking from 500 years ago. Our first reader will be the voice of Columbus, And these are excerpts from the Journal of Christopher Columbus. Our second reader is the voice of Native peoples in the Americas around 1492. And the third voice is two different commentaries on the coming of the Europeans. One is a priest, Bartolomé de las Casas, and the other is Howard Zinn from his book, The People's History of the U.S. So I would ask, these are very brief readings, and I would ask folks to really listen and perhaps try to imagine the people, honor the people and imagine the people who are speaking. And then afterwards, I'll ask each person simply to offer one word of response, perhaps the emotions that you feel upon hearing these voices. Okay, readers?
These Arawaks are well built with good bodies and handsome features. They'd make fine servants. With 50 men, we could subjugate them all and make them do whatever we want.
We always had plenty. Our children never cried from hunger, neither were our people in want. The land, being very fertile, never failed to produce good crops. Our village was healthy, and there was no place in the country possessing such advantages, nor hunting grounds better than those we had in possession. If a prophet had come to our village in those days and told us that the things were to take place which have since come to pass, none of our people would have believed.
This week we selected the 500 best specimens of the 1,500 Arawak men, women, and children brought in to serve as potential slaves. They will ship out tomorrow for the slave markets in Spain.
200 of the 500 died en route. Between the slave trade, hard labor, murder, and suicide, half of the 250,000 Arawaks of Hispaniola died within the first years. By 1515, there were 50,000 left. By 1530, 500. And by 1650, there were no descendants of the original Arawak people left on that island.
For the indigenous peoples of America, October 12, 1492 marks the beginning of a nightmare of genocide and ethnocide. In 1492, we numbered 70 million. 150 years later, the population had been reduced to 3.5 million.
Endless testimonies prove the mild and pacific temperament of the natives. But our work was to exasperate, ravage, kill, mangle, and destroy. Small wonder, then, if they tried to kill one of us now and then.
They tore down our fruits. They cut off our branches. They burned our trunk. But they were not able to kill our roots. The first Americans mingled pride with the singular humility. Spiritual arrogance was foreign to our nature and teaching. We believed profoundly in silence, the sign of a perfect equilibrium. Silence is the absolute poise or balance of body, mind, and spirit. The one who preserves selfhood is ever calm and unshaken by the storms of existence.
Thank you. Could I ask people simply to offer a word, to go around the room and offer a word in response, a word representing your feelings upon hearing these readers? Maybe starting over here?
This is an incredible contrast to the view of the world that the people have.
Go ahead.
Sadness. Shame. Sick. Too much like the Holocaust.
Huh. Well, in defense, I can say that Columbus was a man of his time. He wasn't probably no better nor worse than the people that he grew up with.
Moving on.
Hard to understand.
Not really. I think it's still going on.
chilling to the first parts. Mm-hmm.
I had thought sadness.
Sadness. Uh-huh. Any from the back over there? Ted?
Anger.
Okay. Horror.
Totally miscommunication. Okay. Lack of understanding. Huh.
Similar thought. Lack of human community among people who are all human.
Uh-huh. Okay. Any others here?
Pain. I would say irony.
Irony.
I mean, when you think what's going on in Sarajevo right now, mm-hmm. it's the same thing. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
I just don't think you're human either. No understanding.
Thank you. I feel like talking about everything everybody said, but I would like to ask folks in the remainder of the hour when we discuss more than just react, if you'd name your name before you speak so that everyone can get a sense of who's speaking. A couple of things that were said here, I'd like to move to another angle, another way of looking at this coming together, or the Europeans coming to the Americas, and particularly what you said about contrast and what you said about it still going on and what you said about it still going on and what you said about Sarajevo. I'd like to kind of move towards those comments and do it by using art. Art is a fascinating way to look at how we as a culture write our history, see our history, see ourselves, see our roots. There was an incredible display of art in Washington, D.C. this year on the Westward Movement in the U.S., and absolutely fascinating. But this is one of the paintings that was there. I have a few copies, and I need to collect everything I hand out here. If I could pass these around, share a couple people per copy, and then from this side I'll pass these around because this painting is in this book also. And it's on page 18. So if you get a book, turn to page 18 and then I'll recollect these. And I would ask you to share. Take a look at the painting and tell me, just for beginners, what do you see? Who do you see in the painting? Who are the characters? Okay, and remember to speak loudly so people can hear too. The Spanish in the forefront, okay?
The Indians in the back.
All right.
Arrogance.
The arrogance of?
This is ours, you know, it's like a claiming.
Oh, this is ours, okay. Yeah, I'm going to write down a couple of things for us to go back to. Again, what do you see going on here?
Conquering new land.
Conquering new land?
Might making right.
Might making right. Before you go into interpretations like that, just tell me a little bit more about not necessarily what it means, but what you see, what the characters are doing. A couple of comments on that.
There's a vision of divinity about the looks.
Uh-huh. You know what, I think it's hard to talk about what they're doing. Let's just talk any kind of responses. It's just too hard not to interpret. A vision of divinity. Could that...
Looking up.
Uh-huh. And how do you see that, Ted?
Well, again, interpretation would be that we have divine right to be here. Uh-huh. You know, very...
Cross and crown. Cross and crown together.
Cross and crown together. There. Okay. Divine right to be here.
Well, the lower left, the people reaching out to the side on the ground. I don't know.
Okay.
Like they're being pushed.
Mm. Oh, they are?
Okay. Is that the Indians attacking them?
Some of you who have the copies have a little bit of a disadvantage because the copy isn't quite as good. But there are soldiers. Well, what do you see in the lower left? Those of you who
it looks like there's fighting between Indians and soldiers.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Oh, is that what the
There's fighting between soldiers back here in the lower left.
The children and the women are, but they're also
take a moment to look at what the Indians are doing.
They're running and hiding.
Running and hiding.
They look evil.
They look evil, okay.
They look like they're like little devils, kind of
interesting.
In the distance.
Okay. Who's bigger? Curious.
Who's the Europeans?
I was saying who's bigger, and you said the Europeans. Okay. Who looks intelligent?
Looks intelligent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, who looks like they might have brains.
It's all this thing with the one in there. Down like.
Well, I think the Europeans were portrayed to look intelligent at that time. Flags. I mean, obviously, in civilization, from what we, they have the flags and symbols, and the swords, and therefore they seem to have more material things, more technology than what I can see anyway from the.
I think our culture teaches us how to look at these two. I think as children, we were all raised in history with the beginning of our culture as being Columbus sailing coming, and so that I think somewhat we're, and I know this is probably the first time I've seen this painting before, but it's the first time I've looked at it kind of through the eyes, having just heard those readings, that I think when we look at something like this, we often have fetters on us from the way that we were.
That comment that you just made makes me want to make a little parenthesis here, so I'll step aside and make a parenthesis. What I'm going to do tomorrow is show a slideshow looking at children's textbooks and how the arrival of Columbus is portrayed by children's textbooks. And it's an elaboration, a fascinating elaboration on what you just said. So, end parenthesis, but that's an important comment that you made. Given what you've just said, I'd like to. Ted, one thing you said about God figuring in this painting, or.
Well, I'm trying to not be. How can you have the interpretive? But if you just look at the description here, in the flag you have a cross, in the back, and then you have the seal of the. I'm sure I'm suspecting political seal. And then you have a sword. And I'm guessing it's Columbus. And then the comment made of, I just want to be descriptive of that. It's just it seems to be all connected, and it's the light of the picture. Anointing is in the focus, and Columbus is very white.
Interesting.
Very white.
That's interesting.
It's an interpretation.
Well, what you say about the light, that anointing light, it was very interesting to see a display of American art describing the last 500 years of American life, because almost invariably that anointing light was behind the European movement west. The people in the covered wagons, the light would be behind them, and in front there might be an angel guiding them on. And it was a very, very, very present dynamic in the art. Let's take a moment to continue what we're doing, but frame it in a slightly different way, and maybe we'll start with that one. I'd like to suggest that, and we'll talk more about this in other weeks too, that there are belief systems that I'll call cultural myths and myth being not negative or positive, but beliefs that we have that we generally don't necessarily know we have, might be very dismayed to think that we have, but that determine our understanding of reality, that determine our ability to see other people, and that those myths, cultural myths, that the look at Columbus is a magnificent way to look at some of those cultural myths and identify some of them. And we'll talk more about some of the importance of identifying those myths. And again, by cultural myth, I mean a belief that explains that helps us explain reality. I'd like folks to take a minute to look at what you've just said and carry on with it and name some of those myths. And you started with one, or someone started with one, the myth that might is right, that might is right and enables, well, let's just leave it at that. Another one that's been named here, and tell me if I'm misrepresenting what you said, but what is that God was on the side of the Europeans.
God's chosen people.
All right.
One of the images.
This is an argument you still hear.
Pardon me?
We still use this argument. If we're going to do something, we're doing it.
Foreign policy.
What you just said about foreign policy, interestingly enough, this painting was commissioned by a Senate subcommittee in the 1930s during a time of unprecedented expansion, and it was commissioned to commemorate an event worthy of, I can't remember, but it was commissioned by the Senate during a time of expansion.
The
1930s
or
1930s?
1930s.
Excuse me, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm quite sure it's the 1930s. Yes, the 1830s, during a period in U.S. history of unparalleled expansion, the Senate commissioned this painting as one that would illustrate an event, civil or military, of sufficient importance to be the subject of a national picture in the history of the discovery of the colonies. The intention was to go back into our national history to find and interpret a sovereign mandate for current policy and future expansion of national borders. And that is from the description of the painting that was in the exhibit in the Museum of American Art in Washington, D.C. I think that to look at the myths that this painting supports or perpetuates is very, very kind of critical to understanding some of the myths that, as you said, run our current, our contemporary reality also. Go back to some, yes.
God's chosen people, the Indians were the heathen and needed God's chosen people.
Okay.
The myth of the Indians.
The myth of the Indians, the heathens needing God's chosen people. Could we also see that as manifest today also, in the way sometimes we see people of color, non-Euro-Americans, as needing help or needing the mission movement of?
We're needing to change
okay.
to fit in with our
okay. Needing European Christians? Okay. Others? And you can go back to what you've already said also.
In 1830, we were still persecuting the Indians.
Ah, interesting.
We were still
yes.
reversing treaties, and the history during that time was very tragic mm-hmm. as far as Indians mm-hmm. are concerned. Mm-hmm. And this kind of supports mm-hmm. what we were even mm-hmm. doing then. Mm-hmm. Christopher Columbus, I have no doubt, said Mass before he left on his trip. He thought he was doing the will of God. He had his own personal chapel. He had his own personal priest who would have come there to give, to say the Mass. And that chapel is in Pennsylvania right now. He willed it to one of his American cousins.
In fact, the Franciscan order accompanied the boats of Columbus and did the religious rituals on the boats on a daily basis. That's very true.
So it's almost like he was feeling that God had ordained him to do this.
And then again, from my perspective, we should never look just at Columbus. Columbus is simply a way to look at our own people, for one thing, and to look at history, but not simply Columbus. Going back to, who was it that just spoke? Oh, you spoke about the history in the 1930s. 1830s, excuse me. What about, look again at the Native people in that picture on the lower right. And I would say just think about the implication of showing one set of people as that insignificant. To me, this painting in some way also says that Europeans and Euro-Americans are those that are articulate, intelligent, capable, competent. What about the right to land? Who does this picture say has the right to land?
Those who have power.
Those who have power?
Good. That's the Europeans.
In a way, that's might is right, isn't it? Might is right to everything, including land.
And including the right to subjugate others, to enslave others.
Might is right, the right to subjugate.
Were they even considered human beings?
Okay. Someone said, were they even considered human beings? And again, I think in looking at all of these, we need to look at today. And I wonder, were the people of color in this painting considered human beings? Maybe not. Do we see that manifested today? I think about, for example, the Iraq War, the Persian Gulf War, and the statement that it was a bloodless victory. And it was a bloodless victory in which scores of thousands, tens of thousands of people were killed, but those were people with a different color of skin and a different religion. So I would almost suggest that what you said, were they even human, is something to name as something that this painting can suggest also.
And in the writings from Columbus, it seems that their value is what he could do with them.
Their value is what he could do with them.
How he could use them. That's how they were valuable.
So maybe that the value of certain kinds of people is how they can be of use to or even promote the profit of other people.
Which I think is still fairly common.
Name them.
Look at people who are trying to earn a lot of money, maybe in the stock market or something, who will buy out companies, liquidate retirement funds, whatever they can do where they can get some. Look at several years ago at the junk bonds. Mm-hmm. Those were people. Those were the. They were people who that was a retirement fund. It was kind of wasn't an issue at all. The people were trying to make the money for them for themselves. They were only looking at companies as to how they could benefit their own selves.
So people in positions of no power, the purpose of those people is to enable the profit of those in power.
Yeah, to be useful to someone.
Well, and your number four, I don't know that I would say white people. I think I would say white males.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see too many intelligent looking women in this picture.
That's a good point, isn't it? I guess we can do the next section on how that still manifests. We can go into a whole section on each one of these.
There was Isabella, though. She was back there with some power, too.
She's invisible, though.
Yeah.
She's not in the picture.
No.
That's her.
And she was supporting the man, too.
Yeah.
That's her symbol.
Okay. What about, let me suggest one other thing. What about whose perspective should we listen to? Should we acknowledge as existing? In this picture, does this picture say, look at the perspective of the conquerors or look at the perspective of the conquered?
Oh, this is a conqueror.
I think that's important. And I think in terms of how we name our present reality, how we read history, the perspective that we look at is critical in how we shape the future. And I would say that that history is written from the perspective of the conquerors.
Even the language we use, the word discovered is from the perspective of the discoverers,
right.
Not the discovered.
Right. Right. Okay. Let's just perspective of conquerors. I'm putting this on paper because I want to reuse some of these tomorrow and expand upon them and elaborate more on them tomorrow. Let's take just a look at the Europeans in the picture for a moment. You've got, obviously, Columbus. Are there any other prominent figures in the European section of that picture?
The aristocratic.
Pardon me?
The men around him.
Okay.
Well, what did they say over the cape? He's certainly disdainful.
Okay, okay.
Hands on
true.
His
true. True.
They look awfully clean for coming off a boat for
some reason. Yeah, that's a good point. And the others in the back, to me it looks like the leadership here is incredibly noble and fine, and the rest are sort of scum. They're grappling for gold down there on the ground and they're fighting with each other. And as I looked at that and kind of contemplated, I think this picture is worthy of contemplating for a while. And as I contemplated that picture, I thought about how frequently it is that we, in our culture, in an individualistic society, we suggest that there is one good leader or a few good leaders, and the rest are kind of peons, for that's a good word, peons. And what does that do to our attitude about people who are poor? To our attitude about people who don't get A's in school? What does it say? How does it lead us to fund special programs for kids who are succeeding and let the other kids not be as funded? I'd just like to suggest that this is a part of a culture that raises up in honoring of specific profound leaders, or not profound leaders, visible leaders, and the rest are immaterial.
Kind of like the people who are right now performing in the Olympics and who are missing.
Okay.
Great athletes are being showcased.
Uh-huh.
The dream team of the United States, you know, the basketball team.
Uh-huh.
And if you aren't on the basketball team, and if you know, everyone else, there's what, 7 or 8 men who are that's America's hope.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's a good
example of it. Yes.
I think I see something else, though.
Yes.
I'm not sure that this is such a laudable group of men around Columbus.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of disdain, a lot of arrogance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I see these as being Spaniards, not Americans.
Mm-hmm. You see this figure as being Spaniards, not Americans, which it is. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
I think there are some mixed messages in this picture. That, and coming in the 1830s, I mean, I don't see these as entirely noble.
Mm-hmm.
And Americans were already looking at Spanish lands at this point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting. So maybe some political reasoning of making less noble the Spaniards, specifically the Spaniards.
I think there's quite a contrast between the way Columbus is portrayed and the aristocracy around him.
And Columbus actually almost looks less Spanish than the others, doesn't he?
Yeah,
interesting point. Well, I'd like to encourage folks to look at the political messages of art. Let's move now. And having looked for a moment at the journey of Columbus to the Americas, I'd like to take a look at another journey. And move now to, I'd like to do some biblical reflection in each one of these sessions. Look at another journey. And let's look at the third journey that I've mentioned here, the discipleship journey in the time of Christ. And again, I'm not just totally jumping across into a whole nother session here, another topic. I'd like to bring these two journeys together before the end of our hour. But look at the discipleship journey in the time of Christ. I'd like us to listen, to read two stories of journeys across the sea from the book of Mark, and always we'll be looking at the book of Mark. Yes?
I just, before you get started on this, I just wanted to make a comment that struck me. Last year I was down visiting some friends in South America, and I just think that people should be aware of this, and that they were talking, we were talking about this 500-year celebration, but my friend, who I went to high school with, said to me, are you still telling, or are you still teaching in your schools that there are seven continents? And I said, yes. And, and she has a young daughter, and she was saying, well, how many are there here? And to tell you the truth, I can't remember whether they said five or six, but there is a big thing for the South Americans. When we speak of ourselves, we speak of ourselves as Americans, and they take real issue with that. They say, you really should say you're North Americans. They feel it's very arrogant of us to say that we are Americans, you know, and that they are Americans also, that we should differentiate. And they consider North America and South America one continent. And, and they said, well, where do you put Latin America? I said, North America, obviously.
Well, that's, I think that's another good point. That
so I just think it's just an interesting thing, because I think oftentimes when we fill out our passport, you know, it says, what nationality are you? You know, I mean, I've come to think now, you know, American, no, you know, it's North America.
Well, even more specifically, the United States.
Canadians take issue with.
Yes, yes. But North Americans, we do fall into North America, so it's,
No, that's a good point, and that's also another example of how we sort of see, tend to see our perspective as the perspective.
So when you said about the continents, I thought of that, and I just thought, well, before you, I just wanted to share that.
Thank you.
Are the Mexicans Americans?
Yes, and believe me, they're North Americanos.
Yes,
North
North America.
Do they call themselves?
Yes, they do, and it's very much a source of, of, well, and even the school I teach at has a lot of, like half the kids are from Central America, and those students also are, they're North Americanos. And Canadians are North Americans.
North American, right, they don't say, right.
No, it is a good point. We tend to think that U.S. citizens are
Americans.
I think you need to say that. Language is evolving, and it's very difficult today to know how American is understood in various parts of the world. A lot of parts of the world, American now is reserved for citizens of the United States, which I think is unfortunate, but I think that's what's happened. And there are people in Central America, when I visited there, kept referring to me as a North Americano, but they didn't call themselves North Americans. They may have called themselves Central Americans, but it's very slippery these days.
Well,
and you are from Canada, and he just whispered to me that Canadians today do not call themselves Americans.
Well, you know, it would be a good discussion to spend a lot of time on, and I hate to cut it off, I'm going to, but I think the point out of there is that in part the importance of language, the words we use, and in part what I get partly from what you said again is how perspective, in general, citizens of the U.S. refer to themselves as Americans and forget that there are that the Americas extend from Canada to the southern tip of South America.
And the dominant group culturally on the west in the Western Hemisphere, the most powerful group, has appropriated that term to itself.
Precisely.
And some others have said, "Okay, we'll let you have it."
Yeah.
And some others have said, "We don't want to let you have it."
Yeah. Good. Well said. Yeah. Well said. Okay, take a minute to shift, and then we'll pull it together. Shift to the disciples shift to the Gospel of Mark. We'll have three people do a dramatic reading of two boat journeys, very brief, that the disciples were called to in Mark's Gospel. And then I'd like us to look at this, and we have very little time, but in three brief phases. For 1 minute afterwards, just don't try to interpret it. Think about the images that strike you, the things that stand out. And then we'll take a minute to look at its meaning in the time that it took place, its historical contextual context, and then we'll try to appropriate some meaning for today, vis-a-vis the Columbus quincentenary. So the readers are a narrator who will open, and Jesus and the disciples, and we'll start with the storm on the sea in Mark 4, and then we will go to Jesus walking on the water in Mark 6. Go ahead.
That day as evening drew on, he said to them,
"Let us cross over to the farther shore."
Leaving the crowd, they took him away in the boat in which he was sitting, while the other boats accompanied him. It happened that a bad squall blew up. The waves were breaking over the boat, and it began to ship water badly. Jesus was in the stern through it all, sound asleep on a cushion. They finally woke him and said to him,
"Teacher, does it not matter to you that we are going to drown?"
He awoke and rebuked the wind and said to the sea,
"Quiet, be still."
The wind fell off and everything grew calm. Then he said to them,
"Why are you so terrified? Why are you lacking in faith?"
A great awe overcame them at this. They kept saying to one another,
"Who can this be, that the wind and the sea obey him?"
Thank you. Move now to Mark 6, Jesus walking on the water. Again, the narrator begins.
Immediately afterward, he insisted that his disciples get into the boat and precede him to the other side towards Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. When he had taken leave of them, he went off to the mountain to pray. As evening drew on, the boat was far out on the lake, while he was alone on the land. Then, seeing them tossed about as they tried to row with the wind against them, he came walking toward them on the water. The time was between 3 and 6 in the morning. He meant to pass them by. When they saw him walking on the lake, they thought it was a ghost, and they began to cry out. They had all seen him and were terrified. He hastened to reassure them.
"Get hold of yourselves. It is I. Do not be afraid."
He got into the boat with them, and the wind died down. They were taken aback by these happenings, for they had not understood about the loaves. On the contrary, their minds were completely closed to the meaning of the events.
Any images stand out? Words? Things that strike you? How the disciples may have felt?
Helplessness.
Helplessness.
Fear.
Looking to Jesus to fix everything.
It always struck me how terrifying it must have been to be in a small boat on the sea in a storm.
Amazement.
Anything else about what it might have been like, must have been like to be a disciple in that occurrence, in those two settings?
Bewildered, just having a hard time figuring out how that could be.
I've heard these scriptures read two different ways. One where Jesus rebukes them kind of harshly, like, "What's the matter with you guys?" Mm-hmm. And one where he's the way that the scripture's read, it's much more gentle, like, "Why were you scared? It was okay." And I wonder which, it's different interpretations. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, how was Jesus' tone? Was he reassuring them, or was he scolding them because of their heart?
Or both.
I think it's both.
Yeah. I'd like to suggest an interpretation, a reading of this text, and again, looking not at the meaning for us, but looking at the meaning in that time and that day. Perhaps a somewhat political interpretation, but to suggest that the multiple boat journeys in the Gospel of Mark, and I believe there are six, have two very important functions. One being symbolic actions in themselves, but a second being a way of holding together in an interesting way the narrative, the complex narrative of the Gospel of Mark. Mark's Gospel has two distinct halves, one taking place in Jewish territory and the other on the other side, roughly the other side of the sea in Gentile territory. Both sides reflect or mirror each other with parallel occurrences, healings, exorcisms, teachings, confrontations with authority, the feeding of the masses in the wilderness. One of each of those takes place in the Jewish territory and one takes place in Gentile territory. It would seem, or one could read Mark's point as being that the kingdom of God will break through, will overcome, will turn upside down the racial, the social, the religious divisions and barriers between people. Each time, the disciples are continually called to get into the boat and make a crossing over to the other side. And that is a difficult crossing. It's a frightening crossing, a challenging crossing. It's one in which they could have said no, not to go to the other side, but they don't. And in each one, the presence of Jesus is there. What is it in this reading? Get a hold of yourselves. It is I. Do not fear. And one could read the Gospel of Mark as continually talking about Jesus pulling down and confronting the barriers between people and asking the disciples to do the same, to go over to the other side, to confront and cross over the incredible racial and religious and social barriers of the time, living in an honor culture where the purification of food, where people had specific social standings and social ranks based upon birth, and there were many, many codes to reinforce those, and Jesus continually confronted those codes. And the disciples, one could read Mark as the disciples crossing to the other side, as the disciples being called to cross over into the territory of the other. The other. And Christ always being there to enable that crossing over, to lead in that crossing over.
Something strikes me in those two stories.
Yes.
I think a little in tension with your last mm-hmm. last comment mm-hmm. there. It seems to me as though the stories have Jesus basically viewing the disciples as confident enough mm-hmm. to do this. Mm-hmm. That they are able to do that without overt action on his part. The image of Jesus sleeping on the pillow in the stern of the boat, which is where the rudder is. Mm-hmm. I mean, Jesus is asleep at the wheel, basically. And assuming that the disciples can, in fact, take care of this. The second story, he meant to pass them by. Mm-hmm. And, as though, yes, they are competent mm-hmm. to be able to do this, but, portrays the disciples as giving up on that confidence that Jesus entrusts them with. And then is when Jesus steps in and mm-hmm. fixes them.
Actually, that's good. I appreciate that. And it's in tension with the very last part of what I said, but it's not basically in tension with the concept of basically what you said is that Jesus was entrusting them to have that confidence, to make that crossing. I want us to do one thing. I want us to take this text and that interpretation of this text, agree with it or not, and play it into our own time, into our own situation for a moment. I'd like to read it again, or have the readers read it again for a minute. Or actually, we don't have time. We won't think about it again. And I'd like folks to close your eyes and reflect on a few questions that I will ask, given this interpretation of the text, and given our task of looking at the implications of the quincentenary. So take maybe 3 or 4 minutes to reflect to yourself in response to some questions that I'll raise. With eyes closed, I think would be best. Think for a moment of an invitation that has been before you or your faith community to journey over to the other side of humanity in order to be with or to support people who are oppressed. And then think, what did you or what do you fear in accepting that invitation? Now consider what myths or values stood in or stand in your way. What myths or values stood in or stand in your way of accepting that invitation? Where did you find the courage? Did you feel or know the presence or absence of God in that invitation? I'd like to have time to have folks share some of that with each other in a couple of small groups, but I don't think we have time to do that now. Let me say that I think that we are constantly called, invited, to make journeys across the sea, to be with, to stand with people who are oppressed, and that we have tremendous barriers to doing so. Some of those are our fears, and some of those are the belief systems that the cultural myths that have been with us since we began to perceive when we were only months old. God, present or enabling, is with us, encouraging us to follow those invitations. I'd like to say that as the week goes on, what we'll do is look more and more at the myths inherent in the Columbus story, how they are present today, how we got them, how they support racism and classism and sexism and other isms in our society, what is their impact on life today in the United States and in the world. I would like to close with another reading, a poem that's become very, I've begun to believe that in making some of those journeys, one of the things we must do is listen to the words of people who are not our own people. We are inundated and surrounded by the words of our own people, and we began to see those words and those perspectives as the only perspective. And I think, and I speak, you know, to all of us, I think that's our reality. And so I've begun to try to find the read the literature of others. And this is a poem from El Salvador, by a Salvadoran poet, that I think speaks to the beauty of making journeys to the other side. When the enthusiasm of our time is recounted for those yet to be born, but who announce themselves with a kinder face, we will come out the winners, we who have suffered the most. To be ahead of one's time is to suffer much. But it is beautiful to love the world with the eyes of those still to be born. And splendid to know oneself already victorious when everything around is still so cold, so dark. I love that poem because it is the voice of the conquered, but it's an absolutely life-filled voice, and I think it's very easy for us to see conquered peoples as not having that voice or that stance. And I also love that poem because I think it is an invitation for all people to join in entering into the perspective of the underside and enter into working on behalf of and with the underside for a common future. Before we part ways, I have to say, you know, I believe so firmly that the first step that we all must take and the ongoing step that we must take is opening our eyes. And I would like to just tell you that in the resource center down here, I stepped in there, and there's a lovely table, I think it's on this end, full of really good resources on the Columbus Quincentenary, including perspectives of Native peoples. So I would suggest that to you. I also will bring packets of information that I have. Here's one book, none of which you can take, but which you could take overnight, of readings and resources, all in here. And here also, I'm not advertising, but I am sort of advertising, a couple of terrific books for educators. This is a book for educators on rethinking Columbus, ways of teaching that debunk and move forward from some of the myths that we have. I have copies of these books.
They're in the bookstore, too.
They are.
And the one that you handed out, your book that you handed out, is in the bookstore.
This is in the bookstore.
That book is basically what these sessions will be based upon, looking at those four journeys with five different tools. And there are order forms for these books, not for my book, but for these books. So I'll leave these here a little bit. You can take them overnight, but be sure also to check in the Resource Center. Thank you.